Hi everyone, I'm Britt, the producer of Crime Junkie, and I think by now most of you know that on April 25th, 2018, the monster known as the Visalia Ransacker, the East Area Rapist, the original Night Stalker, and most recently the Golden State Killer, was apprehended and revealed to be Joseph James D'Angelo, a former police officer in both Auburn and Exeter, California, during some of the time he was active as the Golden State Killer. To say that Ashley and I were ecstatic is an understatement. We knew you junkies would want our take on the case, but we also knew we couldn't do it justice in the time you'd want it. So we went to Mike Morford, one of the hosts of Criminology. We've been following season 2 of their show, covering the Golden State Killer, and knew that he'd be a great resource to get a high-level overview of this saga that came to a vindicated head this week. So with that, here's Ashley's interview with Mike.
Well, it's nice to, like, phone meet you.
Yeah, it's, a little different than playing, tag on social media, I guess.
Tag on Twitter, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
So I am a little less prepared than I wanted to be. It's been, we've never covered the East Area Rapist, or Golden State Killer, whatever you want to call him. And I know about him, obviously, as much as, like, the layperson does. So I was planning on doing a little bit of research to kind of help direct the call, but I wanted to get you when I could. So I'm hoping that you can kind of lead me through it. Everybody keeps, like I said, keeps asking for us to do this case, and I don't like doing cases that I think other people have done really well. I just think it takes away from our show, and why do it when someone's done it better? So you guys have done, like, a really good job, and it's been your whole focus for a while now.
Yeah, I can walk you through as much as you need to know and try and give you an idea of the basics of the case.
Yeah, if you wouldn't mind, I think that's kind of what the listeners are hoping for is a little bit of a narrative of a story for those who aren't as familiar. I know for the full deep dive, I'm going to send them to your podcast, but if you could kind of give us a high-level overview of kind of hit the story of the East Area Rapist and when it started, how he kind of transformed. And then obviously you and I are recording on the day that he was arrested, so this is kind of crazy.
Yeah, it's been kind of hectic, but I'll start at the beginning. You know, so back in June of 1976, in the town of Rancho Cordova, which is in Sacramento County in Northern California, there was a rape, and you know, it was a weird rape, and the fact that the guy came in, he had a whole plan and it was laid out well, and he stuck to a certain script and did things in a certain order, and he succeeded. And then there was a series of rapes in the town and the neighboring town afterwards, and they started to be once a month and then a couple times a month, and they just started going on and on and on faster and faster. And he moved out of Sacramento County and into other parts of Northern California and other counties. And along the way, he had 50 rape victims over 3 years. And he moved down to Southern California after that, and that's when he started killing people. And they later on linked, you know, by a DNA, the Northern rapes with the Southern rapes and murders that he did down there. And that's sort of what led to the, you know, the DNA evidence that they actually used to catch him today.
So the attacks that he did in Northern California, did they know for sure that they were all connected? I know they were obviously scared of someone. Did they realize how prolific he was in Northern California, or was it not until the DNA?
Yeah, so in Northern California, where he was known as the East Area Rapist, he started attacking the eastern half of Sacramento County. And that's how he became the East Area Rapist. And he had a very strict MO. He had a very unique signature. He would order, you know, if there was a male home with the woman, he would force the woman to tie up the male as he held them at gunpoint, and he would stack dishes on the male's back, and he would take the woman in another room and rape her. And if he would tell the male, if I hear these dishes fall, I'm going to kill you and her. So he would do this, and he stuck to the script over and over and over again. Now, sometimes when he would attack a woman by herself with no man in the house, he would use a knife as opposed to a gun. So he felt that he was able to control them a little bit better without needing to use a gun.
Mm.
So the MO is very unique. So when he did these different rapes, you know, people could tell, you know, it was him at these different attacks. And all 50 attacks, he would bound the couples in a certain manner. Sometimes he would go to the refrigerator and eat food right out of the refrigerator during the attack. You know, so they started seeing all these different signs and questioning all these victims, and they all reported the same things. So they all, you know, they knew from the MO and the signatures which rapes were his and which ones weren't. And, you know, he basically got the 50 rapes, and they knew they had, you know, the big problem.
And did he, if I remember correctly from your earliest episodes this last season, he didn't start with couples, right? He actually kind of started with younger girls, if I remember right.
Yeah, so the first victim was a lone female that was in her 20s. She was home at her father's house, and he had gone on some family business for a month. So she had the house to herself. So he attacked her first. And the second victim were actually sisters. He attacked them when they were home alone. He raped one of them. He didn't rape the other one. And they were, again, they were teenagers. And then he would come back to the same area he did the first attack in, and he raped or tried to rape some teenage girls there, but their mom was home and fought him off. But after that, the victims changed. Some of them were in their 30s, and then one that was as young as 12. But most of them were in their mid to upper 20s, 30 years old. So that's how he started with those. And again, if it came to where there was a man in the house, then those were typical married women or women that were old enough to have a boyfriend, mm-hmm. whatever. And mm-hmm. and those were typically older to where they could, if he was with them, he would feel the need to separate them and put those dishes on the backs of the males just to give them an alarm system, I guess. So that's how that came, you know, the MO came to be.
Do people believe that he changed it as more of a challenge or just part of him evolving or what?
You know, they don't know it's an original signature, a very unique MO. You know, certain profilers have looked at hundreds of cases and have never seen that kind of, you know, unique signature in some attacks mm-hmm. where somebody stacked dishes on a person's back. So it was a way of alarming him should something, you know, the guy try and make a move or something. That was his way of hearing it while he was out in the other room attacking the woman. So mm-hmm. that was unique, and they knew that was unique. And that was one of the easy ways they would spot him when he did different attacks. You know, another thing was he would always tell the people the same line. You know, I'm going to just rob you. I'm going to take some money. I'm going to take some food. I'm going to go escape in my van that I've got outside. If you cooperate, I won't hurt you. And he told that to several people. You know, it was always the same script. And that's another way they were able to determine which attacks were his and which ones weren't. So it was all very unique, the signature and the script that he used.
And there was, I think it was the first one, if I remember correctly from your podcast, that he had actually been calling the girl before and after the attack. Is that right?
Yeah. So sometimes in the very first attack, you know, she would see a car driving by her house frequently, and when she looked out, the person would look away. And then she started getting phone calls, and the person wouldn't say anything. They would just hang up. And then, you know, after her attack, she still got these phone calls, and they got the idea they should put a recording device of some sort on her phone to record somebody calling back. And they got a call, you know, a taunting call that, you know, he was saying, I'm going to kill you, and he was calling her all kinds of vulgar names. And she determined that was the voice of the guy that had attacked her. So they knew that he was calling them after the fact.
Thank you.
That happened to several victims.
Oh, it did. It wasn't just the one.
No, it was many victims. And in fact, some of them received calls 5 years later. One of them received a call. She was attacked, I think, in 1977, and she got a call in 2001.
Oh, my.
All those years later, he was still doing that kind of stuff. So it's kind of mind-boggling the terror that he was into instilling fear in these women.
Right. And so, I mean, we obviously know now that he's Joseph D'Angelo, right? 72. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
So I think everyone's kind of, again, we're a couple hours into this. Everyone's piecing it together. But he was a police officer, right? Which is what everyone had kind of speculated before, because he somehow was one step ahead of all the things that they were doing. Was he actually an officer in the areas where this was happening, or he just knew how they operated?
So he was an officer in Auburn, California, which I think is... if I remember correctly, is a little bit outside of Sacramento County, not directly in there. And he was an officer, if I'm not mistaken, from 1973 to 1979, or maybe it was 76 to 79. But during that time, you know, a lot of people said, how come he knows what we're doing? Mm-hmm. We're trying to catch him, and he knows that he sort of has the upper hand all the time. And a lot of people did speculate that he might have been a police officer. Now, he wasn't a police officer right in those towns that he was striking, but he still, you know, may have had some kind of advantage from being a police officer. But, you know, maybe as the investigation unfolds and they release more information, we'll know, you know, more about that. But as now there's not a lot known about it.
Mm-hmm.
He did get fired from his job for shoplifting. And, you know, one of the things he shoplifted was dog repellent, which, you know, I don't even know what that is.
I saw that and I was like, is there such a thing?
Yeah, I'm looking at him like, is it dog repellent? I've never heard of it, but he come to find out it's some kind of repellent to keep dogs away from you, which makes a lot of sense because if he's sneaking all these yards and houses, there's dogs that might attack him, you know, and maybe he thought that would scare him off. And another possibility was that he knew dogs would be tracking him and he didn't want them to catch his scent.
Mm-hmm.
So they
mm-hmm.
figured that would interfere with his scent possibly.
Oh.
And in a couple of scenes, the dogs did react weird to his scent. So it could have been because he was using that stuff to mask his smell.
But how smart of him or conniving of him were like, even back then, to be worried about getting caught purchasing that. You know what I mean? Like as a police officer, he was purchased, I think it was a hammer and the dog repellent, which I don't think would be too weird, but he was obviously like aware enough to want to steal it.
Well, and that's the weird thing, because maybe as a thief, he was, you know, as a criminal, maybe he just figured, why should I pay for it if I didn't steal it? If he had bought it, nobody would probably pay 2 cents to him. You know, he would have still been a cop and still been doing what he was doing. But I think he was fired in 1979, and in 1979 is when the East Area Rapist moved down to Southern California and started killing people, raping and killing people down in Santa Barbara County and Orange County down there, Ventura County. So those three areas started getting attacked right around the time he stopped being a police officer. So it'll be interesting to see maybe if he had some other kind of job at that point that brought him down there.
That was my next question, if we knew what that was. Where was it, in Northern California or Southern California? I remember a lot of people made a big deal about papers that were left outside of a crime scene. It was like a school paper, or it looked like a book report, and then like a map of a neighborhood planning.
Yeah, that was Contra Costa County. That was one of his last attacks up there. And one of the scenes, the dogs tracked the scent and across the field and along some train tracks, and they lost the scent there, and they figured that it was a spot where he had parked at and then left. But right where he was parked, they found some papers on the ground that they think he accidentally dropped. And these papers were, you know, kind of weird things that didn't seem to go together. One of them looked like a sketch of a community, like he was planning on building a community or something like that. The other sketch was like the other paper was a sixth grade essay of how bad he hated this sixth grade year of school. And then the third paper was an essay on General Custer. So these three things sort of didn't go together, but they were all found together and they were all on the same kind of paper. So they kept them as evidence. And the interesting thing is today somebody just produced some of his handwriting from a document that he signed, and it does, again, I'm not trained, but to me it matches. I'm pretty sure that it's clear that he did write that stuff and dropped it there.
So it wasn't a red herring. It very well could have been his stuff, but we have no idea what sense to make of it still.
Yeah, it might have been just where he went to climb in the car and somehow he was in a hurry to leave and knocked it out and didn't see it. And that's how they got it. You know, had he not dropped that there, they wouldn't have had that to go on. But, you know, it's one of the only times he really slipped up and left something at a scene that was a pretty big clue.
So when he moved down to Southern California, I remember reading that one of his victims, they felt like maybe he knew her because it was the way in which she was murdered was just so much more brutal than the others. Is that true, or did I mishear?
Well, so when he moved down there, he had never killed. Well, technically, he had been considered the murderer of a couple, an Air Force couple that was walking their dog, and they suspect that they walked up on him as he was prowling in a yard, and he killed them both. So he was suspected of that, but he had never officially murdered anybody. Now, when he went down to Southern California, he started attacking, raping, and murdering the couples. And he would shoot them, or he started even worse, he started bludgeoning them. And with the bludgeoning, you know, he's beating them with force, and it's more of a personal style attack. So a lot of times they started thinking that he knows these people, and whoever that murdered them is somebody that knew them because they were bludgeoned in a frenzy. And, you know, that's typically, I guess, through investigations, that's typically true. But it remains to be seen if he did know them. Now, maybe he did, and that will come out, too, that he knew some of the victims. But the last victim, in 1986, she was beat savagely. And it's interesting because there was a five-year gap where he wasn't known to attack anybody during that 5 years. But when he attacked again in 1986, he really was rough on the girl that he murdered. And he beat her probably worse than many of the other people that he bludgeoned. And the interesting thing is, you know, 1981 to 1986, there's a five-year gap where he didn't commit any murders. Well, I did some research and I found out that two of his children, he's got three kids, two of them were born, one was born in 1981 and one was born in 1986. So whether their births or his wife being pregnant or something along those lines set him off, I don't know. But it'll be interesting to see what comes out of, you know, the materials as they release them to see what drove this guy to do what he did.
Yeah, so you obviously have done some digging. Is there anything else that you have learned about this guy? I mean, I know everyone's still kind of piecing it together bit by bit.
Yeah, I don't know a lot more than most people. I got a little advance notice last night before they announced anything, and it was weird because I didn't know at the time, but I was the first person on Twitter tweeting about the stuff.
Wow.
And then it just sort of went crazy, and it was like, you know, just retweet, and I'm like, wow, this is crazy. But then I looked and I saw nobody else was tweeting about this, so I realized that I was the only one that knew about it at that point. You know, but with the information I had, which was very limited, I knew the guy's age and some general information about him. I didn't know his name at the time. I found that out a little bit later. But things got moving pretty fast overnight. And then this morning I got a call from somebody and it sort of solidified everything that I already had. So by this morning, you know, it was pretty clear what was going on. And then at the press conference today, we were able to find out some more information about him.
Yeah, and this isn't, I mean, something that you just like picked up overnight. You said you actually were on a panel last year at CrimeCon, is that right, about this case?
Yeah, so I'm friends with some of the victims and the surviving victims and family members of those that didn't survive. And, you know, I got to be friendly with them. And, you know, I started wanting to see if I could help in any way. And one of the ways I, you know, volunteered to help was going to CrimeCon and helping them present the case about the Golden State Killer, which was in 2017 now, actually. And at the time, the case, it's weird, the case really didn't have that much national appeal. Not that many people knew about it. And just a year later, this CrimeCon, it's like huge mm-hmm. news. Just about everybody knows about it. Mm-hmm. So in that short 1 year period, the case really, you know, the case really exploded. So that's sort of how I got into it. And I did a lot of research and, you know, I had some connections in law enforcement that were investigating it. So, you know, I was able to get my hands on some stuff to help, you know, tell the story a little bit better on our podcast. So it was a big aid in doing that.
Yeah. You guys have had like incredible episodes and incredible interviews. It's like nobody else has done, which I think is part of it. I think it's like, you know, everyone is pointing to Michelle McNamara's book, but I think it was a collective thing from everyone still talking about it, her book, her, the podcast, like everyone just caring enough to try and still get tips. I think a lot of times, like I know I work with a ton of cold case detectives, and the number one thing is if people just think no one cares anymore, they don't come forward.
I think you're right about that, and it was weird to see the amount of people from 40 years ago that were retired. You know, they retired 20, 30 years ago, and they're still going out to these shows and being interviewed and trying to help, and then the family members of victims that were murdered keep telling their story over and over again, which I always, mm-hmm. you know, I just thought was brave to be able to go through those emotions mm-hmm. again over and over again and to help tell the story. That's what they've done. So everybody doing this effort and then spreading it on social media has really helped move this case to where it's a household name versus what it was.
And did in all of the talks that you've given and the people that you've talked to, did Joseph DeAngelo's name ever come up, or is this just one of those like out of nowhere guys?
This is an out of nowhere guy. From everybody I've talked to, he's a real surprise. You know, I've talked to a couple people that did a lot of data mining on different people of interest throughout the counties where he struck, and collected thousands and thousands of names of people that might be mm-hmm. possible suspects. And this was a name that nobody really had on their radar. And it also turns out the interesting thing is they're gonna link him to something called the Visalia ransacking case. That took place before the East Area Rapist Crimes. That was in 1973 to 1975 in Visalia, California. And that's a case where the offender was burglarizing a lot of homes, but not raping or attacking anybody. But he eventually did try to kidnap a girl, and her father tried to intervene, and he was shot and killed.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so then later, a police officer cornered the guy, and he tried to kill the police officer by shooting at him. You know, so there are, you know, a kidnapping charge there, a murder, an attempted murder there, charges there. If they can positively link to him, he'll probably be facing those charges on top of all the other murder charges that he has now.
So he started way before anyone even thought that he did. And there's like a very clear path of escalation. That's
it is. And the interesting thing is when he left Visalia, the last time he attacked was 1975. He had, again, only one attempted abduction, no known rapes. And then he showed up June of 76, which is, you know, about 6 months later, and he's suddenly raping, and he's doing it proficiently. So it's almost as if in a six-month, you know, time frame, he suddenly changed MO drastically. So maybe there are some victims in between where he phased over to that. But one way or another, they think that he did commit the first series of crimes in Visalia, so they're going to try and link them to him as well.
Was the last one in Visalia where he tried to abduct the girl and ended up murdering her father, or was that somewhere in the middle?
That was Visalia. He tried to abduct her, got her out of the house, and the father caught them outside the house, and he was shot.
And was that the last case, though, that happened there?
in Visalia, no. And they had stakeouts. And one of the areas that they staked out, a police officer was sort of sitting in a garage waiting for this guy. And sure enough, he shows up there. And the officer, you know, shined his light and said, freeze. And the guy said, please don't shoot me. And the officer sort of let down his guard a little bit. And the guy pulled out a gun and shot at the officer and hit the flashlight that he was holding. And the guy was able to get away. So he definitely wasn't afraid to kill when he needed to. Mm-hmm. He definitely mm-hmm. tried to preserve himself without getting caught. And if he was cornered and he needed to make an escape, he wouldn't hesitate to shoot somebody.
And if I remember correctly, too, so you said there's a six-month period before he shows up again and is brutally raping these women, and something might have happened in between. But even during the East Area Rapist, when that was going on, there were like weird blocks where he would disappear for a little bit, right? Like for like 3 months at a time.
There were stretches where, you know, a 2 month period, a 3 month period, a 1 month period where he wouldn't attack. And then there were stretches where he might attack three times in 2 weeks. And at one point it seemed like they were coming faster and faster on top of each other, and they suddenly stopped for 3 months. So that's another thing. It'll be interesting to see what was going on in his life that caused him to take those breaks. You know, if they can tie some kind of, maybe he was away training for something. Maybe he, you know, had an injury. Is there anything they can tie to the breaks and the crimes to, sort of help tell the story about what he was doing and how he was doing it?
Yeah. And do they even know where they're going to try him at this point? I mean, he was all over the place. There's so many different, I think like 10 different counties.
Yeah. It's sad because all the rapes can't be tried. The statute of limitations ran out on them. And back then it was a very short statute of limitations. I think it was like 5 years. So after 5 years, they couldn't even arrest him for any of the rapes, which is crazy. But all the murders, attempted murders, things like that, those charges are still enforceable. So in each of the counties where he's got these murders, he's going to probably face murder charges in all of them. So they started out with Ventura. They moved back up to the young military couple that was killed in Sacramento. They're going to charge him with those. And then they're going to move down, I think, to Santa Barbara and Orange County and charge him with murders down there as well. 12 murders altogether that they think he committed. I think he committed more, but many of those murders are DNA linked, so they know that he committed just about all the ones they're going to charge him with. But I suspect there's more out there that they haven't discovered yet.
I was just going to ask you, and I never saw a ton of this, but do people think he ever wised up and started not like trying to avoid leaving his DNA? I mean, like, I wonder how long he was active for, because it doesn't seem realistic that he would have stopped. Back in the 80s, he was still very young.
Well, and that's the thing. So being in law enforcement, he might have got a heads up that they were coming up with this stuff called DNA, because back then they didn't really know anything about DNA.
Right.
Being in law enforcement, he may have had some kind of insight to know, hey, they're coming out with this DNA stuff, I got to be careful. Because he didn't leave any prints. He was very careful about not leaving prints, not leaving evidence, except for the one time he may have dropped his papers. But he didn't know about DNA, so he was leaving semen all over, you know, the state. And they were collecting it and getting his DNA sample left and right. And that's what they wound up linking him with. And I think that's what ultimately led to his arrest. I think they were able to get some success running that DNA through some databases and then linking it to the right family. And then they tracked through the family and tracked to him. And I think that's what's going to come out on how they caught him.
Do you know how long ago, because I know they said they got it through something that he discarded, his DNA. Do you know how long ago that was, though, when they had been, like, tracking him and collected that, and how long it took to process?
My understanding, it was this week.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they suspected it was him. They waited patiently and found some DNA on something that he discarded, and they tested it immediately and got a direct hit, 100% match. So it was at that point they knew they had their guy, and then they went in and arrested him and were able to take him into custody.
And he was living with his daughter and his granddaughter at the time. Is that right?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know his exact family dynamics. I've heard some mixed things about that. I know that the kids that he had were older. You know, I know he had at the time, I think he had a 30-year-old daughter, a 35-year-old daughter, if I remember correctly. So I think his other kids were older.
And then I remember reading at least in one place, and I don't know if this was like the accepted profile, but I remember hearing before that they didn't think he would be like a married man, but from what they're saying is his marriage record show that he was married way back in like the early 70s. So he was married like the whole time this was going on. Is that right?
Yeah, from my understanding, he did have a long-term relationship, which is a little bit opposite of what I thought. I thought he would be somebody that either never got married or he got married several times because he had marital issues. But apparently he was married, you know, a lengthy time. But one interesting thing I found when I went searching through the newspapers when I first got his name, I found a wedding announcement back in, I think it was 1970 for him, and he was engaged to marry a girl named Bonnie. Well, something must have happened. They broke up and they didn't get married. But at one of the crime scenes, he was whimpering and crying in the corner, and the person was listening to him, and he said, "Bonnie doesn't like it when I do this stuff." You know, so that was one of the things that, he was sure that he had the Bonnie, and then I found that he had been engaged to a Bonnie. So that's, something that stuck and hit me immediately.
I had never even heard that. That's crazy.
Yeah, it's one of those weird things where, you know, if you don't know all the facts of this case and you haven't looked at it, it's easy to miss a lot of little clues and things. But having read through just about every report, 10 times, you know, there's certain things that definitely stick out that you tend to remember, and that was one of them.
Do you know Bonnie? Did she pass away? Did they do we believe that they just called off their engagement, or do we have no idea what happened to her?
Yeah, I don't know what happened to her. I know she did get married to somebody else a couple years later. It wasn't to him; it was to somebody else. And I don't know if she's alive or what happened to her after that. I just know she didn't marry him.
And then did he go on to marry his current wife? Was it around 73?
Yeah, I think it was in the early, I want to say it was 73. And he married her, if I'm not mistaken, in Tulare County. And Tulare County is important because that's where Visalia is. As a matter of fact, in the record of the marriage, it listed his wife as living in Sacramento County and him as living in Tulare County. And that was 1973 when the Visalia ransacker attacks were happening. So that's a link that's going to put him in that county, which is probably going to further make the case that he was a Visalia ransacker.
And so weird that it started like right as he got married.
Yeah, it seemed like that's when it did start. Now, because he was prowling and he was out all hours of the night calling victims at night, prowling, attacking, it seemed like, I don't know how he went to work. You know, I don't know what shift he worked, but if you're out till, from dark until 6, 7 a.m., how do you function and go to work after that? But he was constantly doing that, and it's going to be interesting to see how he accomplished that because it doesn't seem possible that he could be up the amount of hours that he was and still function and have a full-time job.
Yeah, and he obviously was able to do it well because, again, nobody was noticing. He was able to have, as healthy of a marriage as you can have with a serial killer because, they had kids, nobody was thinking it was this guy. It's just super strange that he could be so normal and no one would suspect him. And it kind of explains why he could hide for so long.
And that's maybe part of it. You know, he wasn't the monster, the creepy guy next door. He was a family guy with a boat in his front yard and a normal house and grandkids or whatever. So that was a bit of a facade, obviously. But from outward appearances, it looked normal. So I think he fooled a lot of people.
So before this guy was caught, how many more episodes did you guys have planned of your podcast?
Well, we had 12 planned. We just recorded our 10th one, which, obviously throws a little bit of a monkey wrench, a curveball to us as to what we're going to do. But we think we're going to finish it out with our normal 12 episodes, but we're going to do a bonus episode we're probably going to release in the next 24 hours or so. Mm-hmm. Just updating the case, saying what's happened, it's a big development. And then maybe in the last episode, we'll spend some time going over what we know and what we found out about the guy and make that part of the last
episode. And I'm sure stuff is going to continue to just keep pouring out. Do you guys think you will, once you're done, I know you guys did the Zodiac season 1 and you kind of wrapped that up, and I know you're now, you guys are doing a book, is that right, on the Zodiac?
Yeah, so we had our season one transcribed over into book form, so that's going to be coming out in the near future, probably over the summer.
Very cool.
We're probably going to do the same thing with this case as well. It's a popular case, and we have a lot of good material, so we'll probably wind up doing the same thing.
So do you think, are you going to go the way of Serial and just, like, wrap it up and be done with it and not go back when there's trials and stuff, or are you going to go more the up and vanish route and kind of follow the trials as it goes on and kind of keep releasing new information?
It would be hard not to go back to it, I think, for me personally, just because, again, I'm knowing the victims and being friends with the victims and some of the family of the victims, it's a little bit more personal. So I don't think I would walk away from it. I think I would still do updates on it and want to share things as they develop. So I don't know that I'd ever do a whole season on it again, but, you know, there might be some episodes left that we can do to just update people with what's going on with the case.
Awesome. And do you guys have a season three already identified?
We don't. And, you know, it's at the end of each season, we sort of don't plan way in advance. So we're sort of, you know, burned out from a long season as it is. And we like to take a week off and just refresh and start thinking about the next project. But with our podcast, we do a highly detailed deep dive into a case using a lot of, you know, police reports and things like that, you know, people that were there, people we can interview. So we have to find the right case that sort of fits that model.
Yeah. And you guys, do you have anyone in California, or you guys are out on the East Coast?
Yeah, we're on the East Coast. I mean, I have a lot of friends and connections and things out on the West Coast in California. But we're
okay,
actually
so it's
got
to be a little bit more difficult to get, like, boots on the ground as opposed to having something in your backyard. You guys keep picking California cases, too. You got two in a row.
Yeah, and that's the thing. We want to sort of keep it fresh and not necessarily go back to California again. It just so happened that the first two were from California. But I suspect whatever case we do next is not going to be in California.
Okay, awesome. Is there anything that like I missed that you want to throw out there? Or anything that I didn't cover?
I think we covered the case pretty thoroughly. Obviously, on an abbreviated version, but, you know, one important thing just to mention, I think at the end of the day, when this guy goes to trial and all the details come out, I think he's probably going to be America's all-time worst serial offender, you know, predator-wise. You know, he's going to wind up being responsible for hundreds of home burglaries and break-ins, at least 50 rapes, probably more out there that never came forward or weren't identified, and he's going to have at least, you know, 13 murders. And there's probably more beyond that that hasn't been discovered yet, but he's going to wind up being, you know, if not the nation's worst serial predator, he's going to wind up being California's worst serial predator.
I can absolutely see that, because I think you're right. I think there's just so much we don't know yet.
Yeah, it's just the tip of the iceberg.
It'll be interesting too to see kind of where he came from as we learn more about him, his background, and I do kind of feel for his family. You know, I mean, God, as you know, a daughter about the same age as his, like, to have your world just turned upside down like that—that's got to be kind of shocking.
You wake up one day and then the police are taking your dad away, and he's the worst serial killer, you know, in California history. I sort of feel bad for them too. You know, as awful as what he did, you know, was, and I feel bad for the victims. You know, I also feel sorry for his family.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out and see if they support him or if they're, you know, if it repulses them and they're not even on the side.
Well, Mike, I appreciate it. Thank you so much. I think this is, like I said, going to be way better than if I just tried to retell a story that hasn't been my whole life for the last year.
Well, I appreciate you having me on. It was good talking with you, and I enjoy the podcast too. So,
and then if there's anything we can do for you again in the future, like, I love working with you guys. You guys are super awesome.
All right, cool. I appreciate it. And I like the cases you cover. You guys pick some good ones. You know, Tinsley case is one of my favorite.
Yeah, not a problem. Well,
I appreciate it.
Thank you again, Mike. It was great talking to you.
Yeah, good talking to you. Take care.
You too. All right, bye.
Bye.
I really enjoyed this interview so much, and we really hope you did too. Huge thanks to Mike for giving us some time to talk about this case that he's been so passionate about for so long. Stories like this one really make us focus on why we do this show. It is so important to continue to cover cases like Golden State Killer, like Nikki McGowan, like Caitlin Aikens and April Tinsley, and so many other horrific unsolved cases that maybe not that many people know about. The horrible people behind these crimes are still out there. Someone knows something, and eventually someone will be willing to talk if they know people still care. Thank you guys so much for listening, and if you want to learn more about the Golden State Killer, definitely check out Criminology Season 2. I, for one, cannot wait to hear the rest of the season. And if you enjoyed this episode, head on over to Apple Podcasts, leave us a 5-star rating, and even better if it's a written review. It really helps new listeners find our show, and we also really, really love reading all of your sweet notes. And as always, check out our website, crimejunkiepodcast.com, and subscribe to our newsletter. We'll be releasing some exclusive news there here in the next week or so, so that's pretty exciting. And follow us on Twitter at crimejunkiepod and on Instagram at crimejunkiepodcast. Ash will be back next week to give you your next true crime fix.
Crime Junkie is written and hosted by me. All of our sound production and editing comes from Britt Prawat, and all of our music, including our theme, comes from Justin Daniel. Crime Junkie is an Audio Chuck production. So what do you think, Chuck? Do you approve?